For most of human history, the fight for free speech has primarily been about repression by the state. First, punishing and silencing people who spoke out against the powerful or against the ideas that justified their rule. This has usually taken the form of jailing, torturing, or judicially murdering dissidents. Other milder forms of punishment have taken the form of banishment, forcing people from their jobs, taking their homes and possessions from them, forced public recanting, and so on. The second form is suppressing information, either on political grounds or in defence of public morality. And this category includes the burning or banning of books, the latter of which the censor in Australia was extremely adept at for most of the last century. Now, these forms of repression and censorship far predate capitalism. Indeed, they've been the norm in most class societies in human history. Even in ancient Greece, one of the freest of all pre-capitalist class societies, Socrates was sentenced to death famously for refusing to recognise the gods recognised by the state and, of course, corrupting the youth. Suppression of dissident speech was central to the defence of the European feudal order against the threat posed by science, the Enlightenment, and the rise of capitalism. And subsequently, in the French and American revolutions, freedom of speech, among other things, was a rallying cry for the revolutionary forces. And when it turned out that the consolidation of capitalist rule carried with it a great deal less freedom than implied on the banners of its great revolutions, new waves of struggle emerged, which in many cases had as a central component the fight for free speech rights. And socialists were involved in these battles from the very start. Karl Marx railed against censorship, which he said exercises tutelage over the highest interests of the citizens, their minds. You marvel at the delightful diversity, the inexhaustible riches of nature. You do not ask the rose to smell like a violet, but the richest of all, the mind, is supposed to exist in only a single manner, he wrote. But socialists don't just value free speech as an abstract ideal embracing the diversity of human thought. The right to publish socialist, anarchist, or even liberal newspapers or pamphlets, the right to demonstrate in the streets, to give a speech on a public corner, to agitate in favour of trade unionism, none of these things were granted without a fight. And here in Australia, during and in the lead up to World War I, the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, were involved in numerous agitations for free speech, for which many of their members were repeatedly imprisoned. In the early 1950s, in another famous case, the Labor Party and the trade union movement led a monumental free speech campaign that succeeded in defeating Robert Menzies' attempt to ban the Communist Party. And in Brisbane, in the 1970s, hundreds of people, including at least one in this room, Sandra down there, were jailed time and again in the course of the free speech campaign that fought Joe Bjorke-Peterson's ban on street marches. So that's very briefly the background. But today, this history can seem like it's been turned on its head. If you take a cursory look at the press, particularly the US press, which I'm going to concentrate on, most people might conclude that the left supports censorship and the right wing opposes it. The right wing media, Fox News and its various offshoots in the States, is engaged in a relentless, daily, never-ending campaign to insist that the right is being censored, that right-wing voices are being shut down by a privileged liberal elite. Now, of course, this sort of woe-is-me dribble from the right is fatuous and hypocritical. It's fatuous, obviously, because Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox News, is the most powerful media magnate on the planet, hardly lacking freedom of speech. It's hypocritical because their demands for freedom of speech applies only to themselves. It's not extended to Black Lives Matter activists who were rounded up in the thousands by police thugs last year. It's not extended to Palestine solidarity activists or indeed anyone who might raise a critical word against Israel. Fox News cheers on every instance of repression and censorship directed at the left. So to watch, you know, Donald Trump Jr., the sort of grotesque, coke-addled, white supremacist son of the former president, wail to Sean Hannity about what a victim he is, like, truly is to see the lowest moral rung to which humanity can descend. But if you switch over to MSNBC, or if you went to the New York Times or the Washington Post websites expecting that, you know, a quick fact check there would prove that these right-wing claims were just some kind of fever dream, well, you would be in for a very sad disappointment indeed. Because in the name of fighting fake news, so-called, and disinformation, the liberal media in the US has over the past 4 or 5 years, particularly over the last few months, engaged in what I would consider to be a stunning and completely reactionary campaign directed at precisely suppressing political speech that it disagrees with. As I argued in a recent Red Flag article, the Democratic establishment and its cheerleaders in the press have done everything they can to make the January 6th riots at the Capitol building in Washington a new 9/11, a galvanising moment that will justify a new era of authoritarianism and re-establish the unity of the US ruling class, further fuse the power of capital in the state and squeeze the life out of any opposition from left or right to the status quo. The FBI, the same FBI which destroyed the Black Panthers by assassinating their leaders and infiltrating their ranks, the same FBI that has terrorised every single left-wing group in US history, is now touted by liberal media as a heroic anti-fascist force. Former top CIA officials, who are now the dominant voice, I would say, in terms of MSNBC commentators, demanded action to protect the inauguration of Biden after the Capitol riots, and they got it. Tens of thousands of National Guard troops were deployed in Washington for the event to shut down any protest that was attempted. And this direct state action operated in parallel with a huge crackdown on right-wing social media, starting, of course, with the infamous banning of Trump's Twitter account, but cascading out into a sustained attempt to drive the Trump right off the key platforms of the internet. Thousands of right-wing Facebook groups and Twitter accounts were shut down overnight. Access to payment platforms and servers was revoked. Silicon Valley really proved in a few short hours that, yes, it does control who can speak and what they can say on the internet, and it is prepared to use that power. Now, the internet, I would argue, is the public space of our age. The claims that have been made in response to this, that, well, these are private companies, that they can do what they want and so on, when they're talking about Twitter and Facebook and Amazon and Google and so on, are, in my opinion, utterly spurious and reactionary. Access to these platforms are akin to the right to access public roads, town squares and printing presses in the past. And, of course, those spaces, the real public spaces, have always been contested as well. There's a long history of both state and private repression of political expression in them. Governments have made protests in public squares illegal or subject to, you know, permit systems and so on, but private companies as well, as they've been handed control of public spaces, have tried to outlaw protests and other political activities on the grounds that, you know, the only thing you can do in private spaces that they control is make profits. And I think in the debate about freedom of political expression online, the left can't get caught up in an argument about state versus private control. We need to demand the right to act and to organise politically online, just as we do in broader society, regardless of whether we're talking about state entities or private corporations who are in charge. Okay. So even as it defeated Trump, the liberal establishment in the US could not stand the idea that so many millions of people voted for him and maintained afterwards their intransigent hostility to believing a word of the facts that they read in the New York Times. And why would they, you might ask, when the New York Times is running articles calling for Joe Biden to appoint an Orwellian-sounding reality czar to his new administration, who would be in charge of policing speech on the web and making sure that, you know, the media companies, in cooperating with intelligence agencies, weren't breaching any, you know, found to be in breach of any privacy laws. Liberal left writer Thomas Frank, who's worth reading, recently had a searing article published in The Guardian railing against this new sort of censorious liberalism that seems to have taken over everywhere. And in it, he argued that in liberal circles these days, there is a palpable horror of the uncurated world, of thought spaces flourishing outside the consensus, of unauthorised voices babbling freely in some arena where there is no moderator to whom someone might be turned, in. The remedy for bad speech, we now believe, is not more speech, but an extremism expert out shushing the world. And talking with Mac Taibbi sometime later about the vitriolic response the article got from his liberal friends, which mostly Frank says consisted of people telling him, fuck you, how can you say that? Frank commented that I had very few people deny that what I was describing was censorship. These calls by the New York Times for reality czar All of these Democrats in committees basically pushing the Silicon Valley firms to crack down on the right, to crack down on what they call hate speech. I've had very few people say this is not censorship. Indeed, I had people saying, well, it's time we got down to doing this. And I think it's not time we got down to doing that at all. The left needs to see beyond its justified hatred for Trump and for the far right to understand what is happening to the public debate. In the name of anti-fascism, freedom of expression on the internet is being shut down. The right to organise online and offline is being undermined. New police powers to repress so-called insurrectionists are being drawn up, and the limits of what is acceptable public debate are being narrowed. Now, of course, one immediate response you could make to the picture I've just painted here is that, well, I'm talking about liberals, not the left, talking about the thoroughly capitalist Democratic Party and its corporate media backers, not the working class movement or even the social Democratic Party. And that is an entirely legitimate and important point. The censorious political atmosphere in the US is being driven not by a working class left, but by a section of capital and its middle class professional supporters centred in the media and in the academy. And recognising the social position of these people is in fact central to understanding why their political instincts are so anti-democratic and punitive. To them, it is entirely right that the world should be run by experts, by qualified people, by people like them. The idea that other people might not listen to the well-educated columnists in the New York Times, that they might suspect the government and the media of shock horror systematically lying to them, is unthinkably terrible. So the problem the left faces in all this is that for many people in the US, liberalism and the left are interchangeable categories. When Fox News talks about the left, it's talking about MSNBC. And this reality has an impact on the left in the United States, and it has setting up the situation in which they operate, and it has an impact around the world, particularly in countries like Australia, which are so tied culturally and politically to the US. So I think the censoriousness that has become a hallmark of modern liberalism has had a significant impact, much more broadly on the left. So I want to move on to try and outline the general approach I think the left should take to the question of free speech and look at some of the issues that have come up. Okay, so in general terms, I think socialists shouldn't have an abstract commitment to free speech as some kind of all-conquering value and means by which we judge every question. Nonetheless, socialists should support free speech in principle. We are not with that left that Hal Draper so eloquently described, who say, as long as we the good guys are not in power, we demand free speech and other such liberties, and we deserve them because we are right. But wait till we get in power. We're not going to be so foolish as to let you, who are wrong, make trouble and corrupt the people. That's not us. We defend free speech not just for ourselves, but for our enemies as well, or at least we should. Our support for free speech is grounded in the basic idea that the workers' movement is a democratic movement, and that every genuine advance for democratic expression, every measure that strengthens popular control over society and the state, will ultimately be of benefit to a movement whose entire social program begins with the idea of democratising every aspect of life. But that is not to say that free speech has no limits either in terms of our right to invoke it or in the right we give to our opponents to exercise it. I think the best framework for understanding this is one that was provided by Hal Draper, the American socialist, in an article he wrote in the 1960s. So I'm going to outline his framework now. So in talking about the limits of free speech, Draper says, we first need to determine the type of social situation where the right to free speech is involved. Not where it is valid or invalid, but simply where it is involved or not. Free speech, he says, relates to a contest of views within the framework of the existing power relations on the basis of the existing state. And this applies, Draper argues, whether you're talking about a capitalist state, a socialist state, or any other kind of state. But free speech is not in question in the context of an open contest of power. And the most obvious case of this, and Draper puts it forward, is that of a revolution. So he writes, the Declaration of Independence was not an exercise of the right to free speech. It was a declaration of intent to engage in a contest of power which preempted the field of any norms of civil peace, free speech included. It represented an appeal not to speech, but to the arbitrament of force. Likewise, the Russian Revolution, the German Revolution, and any other revolution. You should not claim that it is the right of free speech which permits you to marshal the Red Militia to seize the White House. The troops would die laughing. Now, this does not mean that there's no question of democracy involved in a revolutionary struggle or any other contest of power. Democracy is a wider concept than free speech. Your right to make a revolution still demands justification and defence on the terrain of democracy, but this is much bigger than the question of free speech. And war is the other obvious example where free speech is not the issue at stake. Draper uses the example of the French partisans in World War II who elected to help the Allied side instead of the legal Vichy government. They were not making a decision to which free speech is relevant, they were merely choosing a side in a war, Draper argues. And that was the main distinction he made in talking about the whole question of free speech. He did deal with the other one, which is the one that's most popularly talked about, which is the distinction between words and actions. And so answering the argument that history tells us that the fascists have to be thrown in the pokey as soon as they express any opinion considered fascist, in opposition to that, Draper wrote, actions, not speech. This is the key. In contemporary America, for example, socialists are for laws making racist acts a criminal offence. If a landlord discriminates against blacks, browns, yellows, or bearded whites, not sure why bearded whites, in renting or selling, a real democracy would crack down on him with a force of law and order. But this has nothing to do with illegalising his right to express any stupid or reactionary opinions on any groups. Now, what Draper's arguing here is not don't demonstrate against Nazis. It doesn't mean don't picket them, denounce them, or yell them down. What it does mean is don't call on the repressive apparatus of the state or other adjacent institutions like universities to prevent them from expressing their views. So that's sort of how Draper saw the question of free speech, and it's a framework I agree with, as I said. It's one that is radically at odds with the broadly accepted framework on a considerable part of the liberal left and some of the actual left today, which is willing to endorse state institutions, universities, social media platforms and so on, censoring speech if it falls into the category of an increasingly broadly defined hate speech. The demand to censor, deny speaking rights to and even sack people for their views is now something that's aimed to ever wider layers of people, including people who are historically part of the liberal or left wing of public debate. Germaine Greer, one of the icons of second wave feminism, was one of the first people to be banned from speaking at university campuses on account of her critique of trans identity. Now, Greer's views on this question are undeniably objectionable and need to be combated, debated, and taken on. But as someone who is still seen by most of society to be a firebrand feminist, to be barred from even speaking on a campus, often at the behest of student union women's officers, is, in my view, ludicrous in the extreme. And there have been many similar cases since. An example came up at Melbourne Uni earlier this year in response to an academic who set up a website that proposed to gather stories about women harmed by men using women-only spaces. An open letter demanding the university to take action rightly said that this website was ripe for promoting misinformation about trans people that may lead to further trans vilification. Totally reasonable point. But the letter went much further than criticising the academic in question to say that we, the undersigned, support academic freedom. However, academic freedom does not mean the freedom to spread misinformation and incite hatred. And this was echoed by one of the main demands of a subsequent rally, supported by some leftists like those in the organisation Solidarity, and from what I understand, a fairly large proportion of the Melbourne Uni student left. And that rally demanded that the university stop selectively applying academic freedom and freedom of speech policies to protect hateful misconduct. Academic freedom is not the freedom to spread misinformation and hate. Now, aside from the fact that selective application of academic freedom is precisely what this demand is calling for, the problem is who gets to define what counts as misinformation and hatred? Because by any objective measure, the policies of both major parties, Liberal and Labor, on refugees spread misinformation and create hate. And worse than that, actually, they inflict direct physical violence. They're not just about, you know, an opinion that might lead to violence. They're about implementing policies that will, by definition, cause violence. But no one's demanding Labor MPs be denied the right to speak on campuses. No one demanded the suppression of the Murdoch Press, the Fairfax Papers, or even the ABC when in 2003, they all promoted the lies that justified the war on Iraq, enabled the governments to begin that war, and you know, a war that killed estimated 1 million people in Iraq. And yet no one raises this as free speech issues because they're spreading misinformation and hate. The left fought against the Iraq war ideologically on the streets, in workplaces and on the campuses, and attempted as far as we could to fight in a militant as possible a way. We resisted and continue to resist the persecution of refugees. When I was a young activist, we went up to Woomera and broke 50 refugees out of the detention centre there. We fought to do what we could to oppose that policy and that the disgusting racist system that underpinned it. But we didn't. What we didn't do was try and, you know, demand that the people whose views we opposed simply not be heard outside the legitimate debate. I think we also need to understand the immediate danger deplatforming, so-called, poses for left-wing academics and students. University administrations have become hugely more censorious in recent decades, with endless new clauses in all of the code of conducts and so on, limiting free speech that I don't have time to go through now, but they're pretty bad. And I think this can only be bad for the left and threatens our ability to organise even around basic issues, even to have political stalls on campus, let alone, this might offend somebody, let alone to, you know, campaign around highly contested things like solidarity with the Palestinians, for example, which time and again has been reason for left-wing academics, even not just liberal democratic academics, to face, you know, losing their jobs, being cancelled and all the rest of it. And I want to say something about the question of cancel culture. This issue is not strictly the same as the question of free speech and really deserves a whole discussion of its own. I think we had one a couple of years ago at a Marxism conference, but they are related. Cancel culture, in my view, has now gone far beyond the perfectly reasonable practice of demanding that people who put forward views in public be subject to scrutiny, to criticism, and to judgment for their views. There's nothing wrong with that. It was a decidedly good thing that Trump officials could not walk the streets of cities like Washington and New York in recent years without attracting withering criticism and, you know, shunning from the public, from, you know, hospitality workers, and so on. That's great. But there's a big difference between that and a heresy-hunting mentality in which any perceived deviation from the political consensus within a certain milieu results in demands that people should not be heard, that pressure be put on their employers to sack them, or that they should be banned by whichever online platform is hosting them. And one of the latest examples of this is the campaign around Substack, which is a relatively new newsletter subscription service used by an increasing number of journalists who've been pushed out of their old media jobs, in part at least because they were highly critical of the liberal media's coverage, some of them anyway, the liberal media's coverage of the Trump era. Now, large numbers of people online now have demanded that Substack not allow the likes of former Intercept journalist Glenn Greenwald to use Substack's platform to promote their views because, in their opinion, he's such a reactionary that he doesn't deserve to be heard. Now, as with the case with Melbourne Uni, much of the argument revolves around this idea of hate speech. But particularly in the case of Glenn Greenwald, it's not just a matter of defending someone whose views the left disagrees with, as is the case with Germaine Greer and others. Actually, most of the attacks on Greenwald, including the accusations of sexism and transphobia, are, in my view, utterly slanderous. Greenwald, a gay man, supports trans rights and has repeatedly put out extensive writings about this, and has not expressed a single sexist view in any of his voluminous works that I'm aware of. The main accusation of sexism against him is that he criticises Hillary Clinton, criticises women apologists for the Democratic Centre, the people who were, you know, attacking Sanders and so on last year. Now, that's why he's a sexist. The hostility towards him is overwhelmingly due to that. Not just Democratic politicians, but also, you know, the journalists who cry harassment every time someone criticises them for shilling for the establishment on Twitter. Now, although Greenwald is, you know, not without faults, his role in championing the causes of Julian Assange and Edward Snowden and opposing the lies of the war on terror, both in America and more recently in Brazil, make him a heroic figure, in my opinion, because he's done it at great personal cost. deserving of genuine respect for the left. And I think the fact that ostensibly left-wing people can argue that Greenwald should not just be argued with when people disagree with him, but denied a platform altogether is just one indication of how cancerous cancel culture can be. Okay, so none of this, though, is to say that the question is not complex. To go back to Draper's framework, there are plenty of things short of a revolution or a war in which the contest of power at least partially subsumes the contest of ideas in which free speech applies. And the most basic example of this is a strike. If an employer tries to prevent workers from agitating for strike action or distributing leaflets at the gate of an adjoining factory calling for solidarity with a picket, they can rightly be accused of violating the free speech of the workers involved. On the other hand, an effective strike is by its nature an encroachment on freedom. Freedom of the bosses to make profits, of the scab to work in defiance of the strike. And on the question of just speech, it would be a sorry picket line indeed that allowed the boss and his agents to circulate through their ranks, spreading lies, handing out leaflets aimed at demoralising and disorganising the strikers. And no self-respecting picket line would allow those people to go about their business on the grounds of free speech. So I think what this indicates for our discussion of free speech is that political judgments are unavoidable in any debate over what can and can't be said. And the only way to avoid this is to take freedom of speech to be an absolute right that stands above all other considerations and is completely abstracted from its social reality. So while it's tempting to try and construct a set of universal guiding principles regarding free speech, it's basically impossible once you start digging into the detail to do so. All we can try and do is establish that the socialist movement stands for the radical expansion of democracy and freedom of expression because we see that aim as intricately tied to the aims of our movement. Now, of course, there's a particular capitalist interpretation of free speech, and that's the one that says that Rupert Murdoch's speech is more important than the millions or the more likely billions of people who read his papers and watch his TV shows. But that isn't the free speech we're talking about. What we are talking about is the right of every person on the planet to speak their mind, to be heard, to air their grievances and to articulate their idea about how the world and their life in it could be better. And as soon as you think of it like that, you realise that the barriers to free speech are not primarily political but economic. The rich have freedom of speech and the poor don't. If you're at the bottom of the pile, you can say what you want. One level, the problem is that no one will hear you. If you're Rupert Murdoch or one of his lackeys, there may be people who object to what you say and try to shut you up, but there's nonetheless little danger that your voice will not be heard. So the fight for free speech, to finish up, is not just about laws and formal freedoms. It's also inseparable from other social demands, the demands for liberty for all, for equality, and for an end to the class system. And these demands are democratic in the essential meaning of the word. They're about popular control over society. And I'll leave it there.